You're listening to a program produced in 2011 as part of Aloud, a series of dynamic lectures, readings, performances, and discussions that take place in the Mark Taper Auditorium at the historic downtown Central Library in the heart of L.A. These programs are presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles, which supports the Los Angeles Public Library. To learn more about Aloud, please go to our website, www.aloudla.org. I've benefited personally from this woman named Henrietta Lacks in a way that my sister, who had polio, did not. Henrietta Lacks was a poor black tobacco farmer whose cells, taken without her knowledge in 1951, became one of the most important tools in medicine, vital for cloning, gene mapping, in vitro fertilization, and more. Her cells were bought and sold by the millions, until Rebecca Skloot's remarkable book, she remained virtually unknown. I certainly didn't know that the development of the polio vaccine, which benefited me but not my older sister, was thanks to Henrietta Lacks, whose own family couldn't afford health insurance. Rebecca Skloot's book takes readers on an extraordinary journey from the colored ward of Johns Hopkins Hospital, colored in parentheses, in quotes, in the 1950s, to stark white laboratories with freezers filled with Henrietta's cells, from her small dying hometown of Clover, Virginia, to East Baltimore today, where her children and grandchildren live. The immortal life of Henrietta Lacks tells a riveting story of the collision between ethics, race, and medicine, of scientific discovery and faith healing, and of a daughter consumed with questions about a mother she never knew. The Immortal Life of Henrietta Lacks, and I know there are many of you here tonight who are already reading it for a book group. It's a great book for a book group. It's a great discussion vehicle. It was named by more than 60 critics as one of the best books of 2010. It's soon to be made into a HBO movie by Oprah Winfrey and the great Alan Ball. And it was not an easy task for Rebecca Skloot to write this book. She exhibited the kind of grit and determination of a writer who knows this is the story she has to tell. This book took her more than a decade to research and write. Rebecca Skloot is an award-winning science writer whose work has appeared in many of our country's leading publications. She's co-editor of The Best American Science Writing 2011. She's worked as a correspondent for NPR's Radiolab and PBS's Nova Science Now. And she was named one of five surprising leaders of 2010 by The Washington Post. And in conversation tonight, we are delighted to have Carolyn Kellogg, who is a Los Angeles Times staff writer. You probably know her wonderful features and reviews, as well as her popular blog, Jacket Copy, which is a vital part of our cultural commons here in Los Angeles. She was a judge of the 2010 Story Prize, and Carolyn is on the board of the National Book Critics Circle. Please join me in welcoming Rebecca Skloot and Carolyn Kellogg, the Los Angeles Public Library. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you for that wonderful introduction. I did not know that about your sister. It's very interesting. So I'm just going to read a little tiny bit from the beginning of the book and then go and sit down and have this conversation with Caroline. For those of you who don't know, the word HeLa, the HeLa cells, is spelled H-E-L-A, and it's an abbreviation for Henrietta Lacks' name. So it's H-E for Henrietta and L-A for Lacks. And I'm going to read just a condensed scene from the beginning. And please silence your cell phones. On January 29th, 1951, David Lacks sat behind the wheel of his old Buick watching the rain fall. He was parked under a towering oak tree outside Johns Hopkins Hospital with three of his children, two still in diapers, waiting for their mother, Henrietta. A few minutes earlier, she jumped out of the car, pulled her jacket over her head, and scurried into the hospital, past the colored bathroom, the only one she was allowed to use. In the next building, under an elegant domed copper roof, a 10.5-foot marble statue of Jesus stood, arms spread wide, holding court over what was once the main entrance of Hopkins. No one in Henrietta's family ever saw a Hopkins doctor without visiting the Jesus statue, laying flowers at his feet, saying a prayer, and rubbing his big toe for good luck. But that day, Henrietta didn't stop. She went straight to the waiting room of the gynecology clinic, a wide open space, empty, but for rows of long, straight-back benches that looked like church pews. "I got a knot on my womb," she told the receptionist. "The doctor needs to have a look." The day before, Henrietta went to the bathroom and found blood spotting her underwear. She filled her bathtub, lowered herself into the warm water, and spread her legs. With the door closed to her children, husband, and cousins, Henrietta slid a finger inside herself and rubbed it across her cervix until she found what she somehow knew she'd find, a hard lump deep inside, as though someone had lodged a marble just to the left of the opening to her womb. Henrietta climbed out of the bathtub, dried herself off, and dressed. Then she told her husband, "You better take me to the doctor. I'm bleeding, and it ain't my time." Hopkins was one of the top hospitals in the country. It was built in 1889 as a charity hospital for the sick and poor, and it covered more than a dozen acres where a cemetery and insane asylum once sat in East Baltimore. The public wards at Hopkins were filled with patients, most of them black, and unable to pay their medical bills. David drove Henrietta nearly 20 miles to get there, not because they preferred it, but because it was the only major hospital for miles that treated black patients. This was the era of Jim Crow. When black people showed up at white-only hospitals, the staff was likely to send them away, even if it meant they might die in the parking lot. Even Hopkins, which did treat black patients, segregated them in colored wards and had colored-only fountains. So when the nurse called Henrietta from the waiting room, she led her through a single door to a colored-only exam room, one in a long row of rooms divided by clear glass walls that let nurses see from one to the next. Henrietta undressed, wrapped herself in a starched white hospital gown, and laid down on a wooden exam table waiting for Howard Jones, the gynecologist on duty. Jones was thin and graying, his deep voice softened by a faint southern accent. He listened as Henrietta told him about the pain, the blood. She lay back on the table, feet pressed in stirrups as she stared at the ceiling, and sure enough, Jones found a lump exactly where she'd said he would. He described it as an eroded, hard mass, about the size of a nickel. He'd seen easily 1,000 cervical cancer lesions, but never anything like this, shiny and purple. Like grape jello, he wrote later, and so delicate it bled at the slightest touch. Jones cut a small sample and sent it to the pathology lab down the hall for diagnosis, then told Henrietta to go home. Soon after, he dictated notes about her. Her history is interesting in that she had a term delivery of her fifth child here at this hospital, September 19th, 1950, he said. No note is made in the history at that time or at the 6 weeks return visit that there's any abnormality of the cervix. Yet here she was, just 3 months later, with a full-fledged tumor. Either her doctors had missed it during her last exams, which seemed impossible, or it had grown at a terrifying rate. So I'm going to stop reading there and then just give you a little overview of what happens next so you know a bit about the cells. So Henrietta went home, and a few days later, she got a call saying that the biopsy came back as cervical cancer. And she was 30 years old, and she was called back in for what was the standard treatment of the day, which was radium therapy, where they would sew tubes of radium, which is radioactive material, to the cervix and leave it there for a few days. And whenever I say that, people just sort of go, ugh. So I like to add that that was actually, it was really the top of the line treatment at the time. Today we have a lot of internal radiation, like the seeds that they used for treating prostate cancer. And this was the early days of internal radiation. The radiation levels were just much, much higher then because we didn't really know what we were doing. So this was just the very early days of doing any kind of radiation and chemo. So she did get the top of the line therapy, but it was pretty awful in terms of side effects. And the treatment itself was done under anesthesia, so she came back to Hopkins, and they put her under anesthetic, and without telling her, before applying the radium to her cancer, her doctor just took a little piece of her tumor and put that in a dish. And he sent that down the hall to George Guy, who was the head of tissue culture research at Hopkins. And George Guy, along with scientists all over the world, had been trying to grow human cells outside the body for decades, and it never worked. And no one knows exactly why, but Henrietta's cells just never died. So they're still alive today, growing in laboratories around the world. And they very quickly became one of the most important things that happened in medicine. That they were used to develop the polio vaccine. They went up in the first space missions to see what would happen to human cells in zero gravity. Her cells were the first ever cloned. Her genes were some of the first ever mapped. They were used to create some of her most important cancer medications, like vincristine and tamoxifen, which probably pretty much everyone in this room probably knows somebody who's taken one of those drugs. Drugs for treating Parkinson's, Alzheimer's, lactose intolerance, and the list just goes on. And Henrietta didn't know anything about the cells, and neither did her family until about 25 years later. And I'm going to stop there because I know we're going to talk about that, so I'm going to go adjourn to that seat over there so we can start our conversation.
Hello.
Hi.
So you weren't there.
No, I was not.
You weren't there.
I was
not there. But you bring these moments so vividly to life. Like, could you talk a little bit about, they told me to pull it closer, but it sounds really bad. I wonder if you could talk a little bit about sort of imagining yourself into that world and what were the guideposts that you had that to make your way there? I mean, like, grape jello was...
That was a direct quote out of her medical records, actually, grape jello. It's a good question. So the kind of writing I do, we refer to it as creative nonfiction, which often confuses people to no end because they think that means you're being creative with the facts, like you're making a lot of this stuff up. And people assume that because it reads like fiction, and I obviously was not there when this stuff happened, that I must have sort of fudged some of these details. But I didn't, and that's part of why it took, you know, over a decade to write the book. So just that little scene that I read, they pull up in front of the hospital, it's a Buick, it's raining, they park under the oak tree. Every detail in that is verifiable from some kind of source. So usually the sort of beginning nugget of any of these scenes I got from talking to people. So in that case, it was Henrietta's husband, who very clearly remembered parking under that tree because it's where he parked every time he took her to the hospital. And he remembered, you know, it was raining and it was such an important day for him. And then I would go and do all sorts of research to fill in details and to verify them. So in that case, you know, I went and got archival photos of the outside of Hopkins in the 50s. Was there a tree there? Yes, there was a tree there. Took it to a botanist. Is this an oak tree? Yes, that's an oak tree. I had pictures of the car. Is that actually a Buick? And yes, it was a Buick. You can go to the Weather Bureau, verify that it was raining that day. I had archival photos.
Really? And this literally. Like three pages? Yeah. This is all three pages?
This is a paragraph. I'm not done yet either. And then she walks into the room, and the room looks this certain way because there are archival photos of the room, but also her doctor, amazingly, he just turned 100. And he has this incredible memory, and I feel like he was much younger when I started working on the book, but his memory has been amazing, and he would remember
he was 10.
These little details. Yeah, right. And so he remembered things like there were glass walls between the exam rooms, which to me is such an amazing detail. Like, these women are actually in these gynecologic exam rooms, and they could see each other between these glass walls with their legs up in the stirrups. And that just says so much about the colored wards and what it meant to be a black woman in the hospital at that point in time. And he remembered those walls, and then I went and actually talked to other people who worked there at the time. They remembered the wall, and I would get pictures. And so the combination of personal memories and photos were sort of how I built those things. And then in terms of the dialogue, like Henrietta walking up to the desk and saying, I have a knot on my womb. In her medical records, it said, you know, patient palpated lesion on cervix. And she most definitely did not walk up to the desk and say, I have palpated a lesion on my cervix. And so then what I would do is I would go back to her family members who were close to her. She had two cousins who were sort of her best friends. And I would ask them, you know, so tell me the story of when Henrietta went to the doctor. And the way they described it is that she always said, you know, I've got a knot on my womb. And so that's a direct quote from her cousins recreating her dialogue. And anytime I could, I would cross-check that with multiple sources. So if there was anyone else who was there at the time, I would try to verify a scene. And in that opening scene, the only thing that came from only one source was the fact that she put her coat over her head. There was nobody else. Her husband said she did it. I don't see why he would have made that up. You know, it was raining. It makes sense. So that one I was like, okay, we'll go with one source on that. But some of the other scenes later, like the her funeral, there was this epic storm the day she died. And the first time I heard the story of this funeral, one of her cousins...
Did it, like, tear down a tree?
Yes. It was, you know, of mythological intensity. And her family often said, you know, this was Henrietta trying to tell us something. She was mad. And they would tell the story, you know, the first handfuls of dirt went on the coffin and the sky turned black and the wind ripped the roofs off the houses and one guy got killed.
And you're like, come on.
Exactly. I was like, this is way too good to be true. Like, just sort of mythologically, metaphorically speaking, this is too good to be true. And so then I went and found everybody who had been at the funeral who was still alive. And I just said, tell me about the funeral. I didn't say, was there an enormous storm? That I didn't want to sort of lead them. And every one of them, oh, the first handful of dirt went on, the sky turned black, and like, the exact same story over and over. And then I still went and verified it with the Weather Bureau, and yes, there was a hurricane-type storm that day. But that one took me a lot of interviews before I really believed that it had happened. But so yes, all of that is why it took, part of why it took so long.
You say that, so there's a lot of stuff that happens in this book, so I'm curious where y'all are in it. Has anybody... I was born in Florida, so I can say that. If you're reading the book, is there anybody who hasn't quite gotten to the end yet?
Or anyone who hasn't read it all? Just so we don't spoil the end. It's okay. Don't be shy. I won't be offended.
Heck yeah.
We don't want to spoil the end.
Okay, we don't want to spoil the ending. But there is a scene towards the end where you spend a lot of time getting to know Henrietta's children, and you become close with her daughter, Deborah. And towards the end, when the two of you are traveling together, there's this very intense scene with one of her cousins. And when you leave that scene, she takes her coat and she puts it over your head together for you two to run out in the rain. And I was like, oh, she inherited it from her mom and she didn't even see it.
That's funny.
So tell us a little bit about how you came to get to earn Deborah's trust. Like, you just call her up one day and you're like, tell me about your dead mom.
Sort of in the beginning, yes. That's where it started. So yeah, I learned about the cells when I was 16 in a basic biology class. And all I knew about them was that, you know, my teacher had said, there are these incredible cells. They've been alive since the 50s, even though the woman they came from died. And he knew her name and he wrote that in big letters on the board. And then he said she was a black woman. And then that was it. And class was over and I just became obsessed with these cells, and I went on and got a degree in science and did research on the cells, and I was always sort of fixated on this question of who this woman was. But I had no idea that the cells were taken without her permission. I didn't know many of the things that happened to her family, which, you know, they didn't find out until 25 years after her death that the cells existed. And the reason they found out is that scientists came back to her children to do research on them in order to learn more about the cells, which they also did without consent. So this was a family used in multiple generations in research without consent. And their medical records were published without their permission. I mean, the number of things that had happened to her family before I came along were really hard to believe. And then I showed up. I was 20-something year old graduate student. I was like, hi, I'm going to write a book about your mother. And they just said, no, you're not. For them, I was just sort of yet another white person coming along wanting something from them having to do with these cells. And it had never worked out very well for them. So
who was the craziest guy?
Oh, Cofield, you mean?
Yeah. Sir John.
Sir Lord Keenan Kester Cofield. Yes, yeah, Dr. Sir Lord Keenan Kester Cofield is his name.
We'll come
As
back
you
to
may
him.
Imagine, he was a bit of a con artist. So yes, he had come along, and there's all sorts of amazing things, including him trying to steal Henrietta's medical records. And so that had happened right before my first phone call, basically. And I didn't know this, but Deborah had recently gotten out of the hospital from nearly having a stroke due to a lot of the stress that had been caused by some of these other events. And I had no idea where I fit in their history. And so when I called and said, I want to write this book, and she just, there was a side of her that really wanted it to happen. This was in the 90s, and they still didn't really know what a cell was. They didn't know what it meant to have these bits of Henrietta alive. And so they had a lot of questions, and she was really curious to learn, but was also terrified to talk to me. So yeah, it took about a year and a half to really win her trust. And a lot of how I did that was by sharing information with her. So she had caller ID, and I would call periodically. She would never answer the phone because she knew it was me. And so she would always let it go straight to voicemail. And part of what I did is I would go out and I would find her mother's relatives, you know, cousins, siblings, and start to piece together the story of Henrietta's childhood, which Deborah didn't know about. She was two when her mother died. And I would leave these messages on her, Deborah's answering machine. You know, oh, I just met, you know, your Uncle Cliff, and he just had this great story about your mom when they were kids. And I would just tell these stories on her answering machine. And later,
this was before voice. It wasn't voicemail. Was it an answering machine? So
yes.
she's sitting there in the room, voicemail. And you're
yes.
like, blah, blah.
And you know, and later she sort of fessed up that she was sitting there like, wanting to pick up the phone, but being sort of afraid to do it. And eventually she essentially did, and sort of got to the
was
point.
Was there
where
one
she
call where you were like talking and like she picked up the line, or did she?
No,
call
she
you
called
back?
Me. Yeah, I had called and been leaving these messages periodically, and I would only do it when I went on trips to go interview her, the family. And there was one where I left a message on her machine, and then she called me back up, and I picked up the phone, and, hello, and she said, fine, I'll talk to you. Then she said, you just have to promise me two things. One, you won't hide anything from me, and two, you will figure out what happened to my sister, which is one of the stories that ends up being in the book. She had a sister who died at 15 that she thought something bad happened to but didn't know, and she was right. And so then this whole idea of just don't hide anything from me was really, that was a lot of where the trust came from in the end. And that's why she ended up traveling with me and why the story evolved in the way that it did.
So, you know, Rebecca's been on tour and has been talking about this book a lot, but you probably don't talk about graduate school that much.
Yeah.
But we went to the same graduate school at different times. You were there way before me.
I'm not that old.
No, I was old. So when I was there, there was this legend of this book proposal by Rebecca Skloot. And so when I met you, I was tired and stupid, and I was like, you're Rebecca Skloot. Did you ever publish that book? And in fact, it was on its way, and you had just met with your publisher. But I wonder if you could talk a little bit about what did that book proposal look like when you were in graduate school, when you were making these trips out to the tobacco farm, and how different is it from what we get to read today?
It's actually pretty similar in a lot of ways. I mean, obviously, there's much more to the story in the book. But yeah, I went to this I did my undergraduate in biology, and then I went, I was planning to be a veterinarian. I had no interest in writing whatsoever until pretty late in my undergraduate career. I took my first creative writing class because the school where I went, for some reason, counted creative writing as a foreign language. And, and so I signed up for this class because, you know, I was very sort of tunnel vision about becoming a vet, and I thought anything outside of my science classes that I knew I wanted to take was a waste of my time.
Easier than Le French.
Right, exactly. I was like, it only meets 2 days a week instead of 5 days a week, and like it was very just sort of logistical. And I took this class, and one of the first assignments that we got was, you know, these writing prompts, you know, the creative writing teachers, who I can now mock because I am one, you know, will pace around the room and say, you know, write for 5 minutes about something someone forgot. And so this was this writing prompt that we got in this class, and I wrote Henrietta Lacks in big letters at the top of my page and said, and started writing about the fact that like everyone seemed to have forgotten about her, but that I couldn't, and that I was just weirdly obsessed with her. So the first thing that I wrote in really was, one of the first things was about her. And then I wrote a lot of other things about some of the science that I was doing, and my teacher at some point was like, you know, you don't have to become a veterinarian. Like, just because that's what you always thought you were going to do, there's this thing called science writing, and, you know, you have this natural writing thing, and you also get science, and that's kind of rare, and you could put them together, and I just never even thought of it. And I really did a U-turn pretty late in my school career, and that's when I went to Pitt, or applied to Pitt. And I went to get my MFA in nonfiction, and then you show up in your MFA program, and they say, welcome, you have 3 years to take all these classes and teach several classes and write a book. And I, being a science major, I'd never even taken other than was one writing class.
And like 2 weeks later, they're like, to you nonfiction people,
right,
they're like, okay, what's your book going to be about? Like, they don't give you any time.
No, they don't. And it's really overwhelming, and no one can come up with a book idea that fast, let alone write one. And I was sort of in this weird mode of scrambling, trying to actually learn the basics of nonfiction, because I had never really done any of that kind of writing before. And so initially, I thought, one of the things that many graduate students do in that moment when they're faced with, you have to write this book like in the next 2 years and we need a proposal by next week, I said, well, I'll write a collection of essays. And this is something that students often fall back on because you can't imagine writing a whole book. So this idea of writing a bunch of little things and putting them together is really appealing. And so I thought, well, I'll write a collection of essays about forgotten women in science. And so I got out this thing and I was like, started to write my proposal. And I wrote a description of what this book would be, why it's important to write. And then I numbered the page 1 through 12 because I knew we had to have 150 pages. And I figured, you know, maybe 10 to 15 pages per woman. That's like, you know, enough for my thing. And I
page
first
count
line,
score.
Right. So the first line I wrote, Henrietta Lacks. And then I was like, I wonder who the other, you know, women will be. And so I thought, well, I'll start with that chapter and then see what happens.
Here you are.
Here we are. That was in 97. And so really initially that's what the proposal was this weird paragraph about why it's important to write about forgotten women and then a numbered list with one name on it. And then I started actually looking into the family, thinking I was writing one chapter in a bigger story. And so I called them just thinking I was going to find out about her. And then I had this phone call with Deborah Ware, and the phone call's in the book, this sort of very manic, intense phone call where she just does this sort of brain dump where she's utterly terrified to talk to me but really excited. And she starts mentioning all these things. Somebody murdered somebody and somebody stole her mother's medical records and these snippets of story. And then she hung up on me. And I was like, wow, that is more than a chapter in a book about forgotten women. Something, and that was the moment when I knew like something had happened to her family surrounding these cells, and I didn't know what it was, but I knew it was much bigger than what I had originally thought. So that was when I knew it was probably a book itself. And then I did what was very unpopular with my teachers, which is I said, I'm going to do all my classes and then basically drop out and go write this book instead of trying to finish it in 2 years to graduate. So instead I wrote this which at Epic Book Proposal as part of my coursework. So it was like 75 pages long, which for a book proposal, it's not unheard of, but it was pretty long. And, you know, part of the trick of writing a book proposal is to convince the publisher that you know what you're doing and that you have a good story and you can sort of handle it as a writer. And I had never written anything before, so this was actually one of the first pieces of writing I'd ever done. And I had done enough research to put, you know, all of it into this proposal. And so you get little snippets of some of the scenes that end up being in the book, which I called a narrative overview of the story. So instead of, usually they want a sample chapter and all stuff, but I didn't have that much information yet. And so I pieced together a lot of these snippets of stories to make it seem like I had much more information than I did. And so that was where the book proposal started.
So did you have the science? Did you know about all the HeLa cells,
not
all the things
all
they've
of
done?
It. Some of it. The science stuff took a long time to sort of piece together. The sort of comparison that I use is that going onto these scientific databases where papers are logged for scientific journal articles, if you go on one of those and type HeLa, it's sort of like going on Google and typing and. It's just this overwhelming flood of information, and it's really hard to figure out what's important, what's not important, what's just sort of a random reference versus what's, you know, some sort of epically, you know, essential science. So it took a long time to piece all that stuff together, but I did know a few of the big monumental discoveries, so I focused on those somewhat. But yeah, it was mostly, a lot of it was about the family and this sort of why it's important to tell this story, that there's, you know, still currently a lot of debate going on about how to handle consent with tissue research. And so I sort of talked about a lot of what's in the afterword now about to where we are today.
So that. So the questions of medical ethics were embedded in the story from the beginning.
Yeah.
That was one of the things.
Yeah.
I think that it's really interesting that there are some people that I've talked to about the book who feel like there's really absolutely not a second thought that it's absolutely okay to take tissues and stuff. And I wonder if you could talk about sort of, is there a difference between the moral and the legal position when it comes to this?
Yeah, well, the legal position is that it's absolutely okay to take tissues for the most part. I mean, there are a few things that have changed since Henrietta's era, and you know what her doctors did was standard practice. We didn't even have the concept of informed consent at that point. But now, if samples are taken specifically for research and your name is attached to them, that does require informed consent. So there's federal law that says you have to ask before you take that. But if samples are taken for other things like blood tests or biopsies and your name is removed from it and they're sort of going to be discarded otherwise, then that saving those for research doesn't require consent. And that really makes up the majority of tissue research. I mean, this.
So like if I go in for a regular physical and they take my blood.
Could be. You sort of don't know. And there's often that forms that say, you know, that we sign that say you can dispose of my tissues any way you see fit. And it's, some of it depends on the individual institution where you go. So if you go to one research institution, they may have their own guidelines that say, you know, they may give you a book that says, this is what tissue research is, and here's the pamphlet that talks about it, and this is why we do it, this is why it's important, and they'll lay it all out for you and get consent. And then you could go to another hospital across town that won't. So there's no standardization of how people handle that now. And it's true. Most people, a lot of people are like, you know, yeah, use my tissues. I don't care. I'm not going to use them. It's not going to hurt me personally. But part of what this story is about is the fact that, you know, this concept of harm when it comes to disembodied bits of you means different things for different people. And that there are some people who, you know, absolutely could not be less fazed by the idea of someone taking their cells and using them in research. But then there are other people who that is actually very deeply disturbing. I mean, one of the real difficult things for Deborah in all this is she really believed her mother's soul was alive in these cells, and she really worried that her mother was suffering as a result of some of this research. And no one ever explained to her what the cells were, or sort of sat down and answered any of her questions about whether her mother could rest in peace when, if they're shooting her cells up to the moon. And so a lot of people, there's a lot of people who just don't understand the science, and it's scary for them. There are people who it violates their religious beliefs. I mean, there are a lot of reasons why people might not want to have their tissues used. But I think, you know, I've talked to people, there have been a lot of lawsuits over this in the last few years, and I've talked to everyone involved in those cases, and across the board, they all pretty much say, well, you know, if they had just asked, we would have said yes. Like, people get that it's important research. I think the sort of majority of people who I talk to, either involved in lawsuits or just doing events like this out in the public, they are happy to do to donate, but they don't want to find out after the fact that it happened, particularly when money's involved. So if they then find out that some researcher or their doctor potentially profited, it just damages trust. So then they start to say, well, then what else are you doing that I don't know about? When in fact, they're not really doing anything, and most people's cells aren't worth anything. And so it creates this, it creates a much deeper mistrust, which, you know, we already struggle with a lot in this country, particularly among minorities, because there has been a big history of African Americans and other minorities used in research without consent, and some white people as well. But so it gets tied up in these big issues of trust. And so I think what people want more than anything now is just disclosure. They say, yeah, use the tissues. We want to know you're doing it. But
one of the things that you did was you set up the Henrietta Lacks Foundation, and that's because in part, although Johns Hopkins didn't profit from the cells that they took from her, other people did. And HeLa cells are a multi-million dollar industry?
We don't really know. I mean, it's really hard. I spent a lot of time trying to actually come up with a number, and it's just, there's no way. What we do know is that a multi-billion dollar industry grew out of selling HeLa cells. So they were the first cells ever commercialized. And now there are enormous industries based on buying and selling cells and tissues and patenting genes. And some of our biggest biotech companies started with this one little company that just started by selling HeLa cells. So there's a big industry there. And anyone can go online today and buy a vial of HeLa cells for about $250, or products made using them for anywhere up to about $10,000 a vial. So there's definitely money exchanging hands. But at the same time, if you'd taken her cells and put them on a table, they would have died. So there was science that went into that, and there's a lot of debate. How do you then figure out how much of the cells is her, and how much of it was George Guy, who did all these inventions to keep them alive?
Didn't he do weird stuff with chickens?
Oh, he did very weird stuff with chickens. He did do weird stuff with chickens. Yeah, he had this whole kind of witch's brew that he put together to feed the cells that it involved him actually going to slaughterhouses, and, you know, it required the blood of fresh chickens and the, you know, snippets of placenta from freshly slaughtered calves and, like, all sorts of very specific, strange-sounding things, which he would go and collect himself, and he would often spend the night in a cot next to the incubators where the cells were growing so he could make sure that the machines never stopped moving, because it had to keep rotating. And and he drained his personal bank account over and over again and really deeply angered his wife many times by spending their grocery money on cell culture stuff. And
sorry, honey, I gotta go buy some placenta for the cells.
Yes. So what he put into those cells, I mean, his whole life was trying to grow these cells. And
is he one of the, but Henrietta's kids,
right,
grew up without healthcare, and when
still have no healthcare.
And with their mother, after their mother was lost, the family was kind of fractured. And I wonder if you could talk a little bit about, like, who her kids were and who you talked to. You talked to Deborah, you talked to a scary brother whose name I'm going to mispronounce.
Whose name everyone is afraid to say because he gets very mad if you mispronounce it. Zakaria.
Zakaria.
Yeah. Henrietta had 5 kids when she died, and Deborah was the second youngest. Zakaria was the youngest, and she was actually pregnant with him when she found this tumor. So he died, or she died, when he was just an infant. And the family had incredibly hard lives. Her kids, right after Henrietta died, various cousins came to help take care of the kids, and one of them gave Zakaria, who was this tiny baby, and Deborah and one of the other brothers tuberculosis. And so Zakaria spent his first year motherless, but he spent a lot of it in this oxygen tank recovering from tuberculosis. So he just had really no human contact whatsoever for the beginning of his life. And then they ended up being taken care of by a woman who was horribly abusive and really abused Henry's children in ways that even their own family didn't know. I was reading it in the book, was the first time their own kids really understood what had happened to them. I mean, being tied up in a basement and whipped kind of beating. And that happened to Zakaria as well. So he got the brunt of a lot of the worst of what happened when the family lost Henrietta. And Deborah got it too. And then Zakaria grew up and, not surprisingly, was a very angry, violent guy. And he murdered a man in broad daylight when he was pretty young, and did a lot of time in prison. He really believed a lot of that was tied up with these cells and the fact that he didn't have a mother. And he really felt like because he was in the womb with these cells that were so angry and volatile that was part of what happened to him. And his story is just is incredible and sad. But in the end also, he becomes sort of an inspiring character because he does go through quite a bit of a transformation by the end of the book. But then there were older
brothers. But
not
before scaring the pants off.
Not before absolutely terrifying me, yeah. No. That's actually, it's funny, when I was finished with the book, I sent copies of the manuscript, a big box of them, to the family. And the younger generation read them, the grandkids and great-grandkids. And then they ended up reading it out loud to Henrietta's kids, who many of them can't read and write. They're all deaf and hard of hearing. So they went through most of their schooling without ever even being able to hear the teachers. So they couldn't really read it themselves. But then, the younger generation read it with them. And Zakaria, there's this one scene where I go and meet him for the first time, and he is absolutely utterly terrifying. He's just like 3 times my size. And, all I knew about him was that he'd killed somebody with a steak knife. And there's this scene where I meet him for the first time, and Deborah is sort of hovering around, being sort of watching over me, being nervous, but leaving us alone. And he makes his kids read that scene over and over. He thinks it's the funniest thing in the entire world. He's like, read that scene again where I scared her to death. So it's sort of a running joke in the family now. I don't know if that answered your question. But,
it's clearly a family who, the book is about so many different things, but in some ways it's about poverty, and it's about a family that could have benefited if there was some way for them to financially benefit from the cells that came from their mother. And so you set up this foundation.
All right. Yes, I set up the foundation. And this was something I said very early on that I wanted to do because as I learned more about their story, I realized, I was coming along and I was in a position to be someone else who potentially profited from this, even though at the time I was sort of going into debt, trying to figure out how to actually do the research and the
driving around with a crappy Honda with no muffler.
No muffler. And taking a lot of student loans. But I knew, I was like, okay, so if the book ever gets published and if anyone ever buys it, I wanted some of it to go into this foundation. And initially I thought of it as an education fund. But then the more I worked on setting it up, the more I realized that wasn't actually all that it needed to be. So it's a foundation that gives grants for education and medical expenses it's given out 8 tuition and book scholarships for members of the Lacks family, so grandkids, great-grandkids. It's also given out, help some of them with medical expenses. It's set up to help people who are in financial need who've made important contributions to science without their knowledge. And so, you know, there's unfortunately a lot of people who actually qualify for that in this country, you know, the descendants of the Tuskegee syphilis studies men, for example, which is, a lot of people know about this. This is, you know, a study where hundreds of black men were with syphilis were studied to see how syphilis kills you from infection to death. And they were never offered treatment, even when treatment was available.
Was it run by NIH? Was it?
It was a national study? It was various various government organizations. Yeah, so it's out there. It's the goal is to help people beyond the Lacks family as well, but obviously also the family.
You were going to read another piece, and I wonder if we should do that now. Sure. We meaning you.
We. You can read it too if you like. You can read along. We have the
same. What page are we on?
So the scene I'm going to read is, I'll do a little bit of an intro to sort of set it up for you. This is when Deborah and I, when I finally kind of won her trust and we had this call where she said, fine, I'll talk to you. One of the first things we did together was go into a lab so she could see her mother's cells for the first time. And one of the things I guess we didn't really talk about was that when the family first learned about the cells in the 70s, you know, it was because scientists came to them wanting to do research on them. And this was in part because of this big contamination problem that happened, where I'll sort of give you the condensed version that scientists, after HeLa cells grew, they started growing cells from lots of other people. They wanted to create a library of different tissues.
So it took like a decade, a dozen years before...
It took a long time to
Other cell lines
Well, they actually grew really easily initially. And so they were taking samples from lots of other people, and they all just sort of grew miraculously easily. And at a certain point, in the early days of gene mapping, this one young researcher started looking at genetic markers in all these cells. And he was looking at a prostate cancer cell, and he found that it had two X chromosomes in it.
And he was like, lady prostate.
Yeah, lady prostate.
That's strange.
And so, right, so women have two X's, men have an X and a Y. You can't have a prostate cell line with two X's. And so he thought, well, that's odd. And he started looking for other genetic markers in this cell line, and they had this very rare enzyme marker that's really only found in African Americans. And even among African Americans, it's very rare. It's like, well, that's weird. This white guy's prostate seems to be from a black woman. And so it turned out that Henrietta's cells had contaminated all these other cell lines out there, because cells can float on dust particles in the air. If you touch a dish of cells and then go touch another dish without washing your hands, you can transfer cells from one to the other.
And most cells would just die as if you had left them on a table.
Right. Yes, and because HeLa cells are so hardy that they'll just outgrow anything in a dish. So... And you can't tell with a naked eye what's growing in the dish. So this was really why the scientist tracked down her family, was to settle this big debate about whether HeLa had contaminated things, how do you straighten it out?
It was a huge, like, even though he thought he had found these answers, people didn't want to believe him, right?
Yes, utterly. Completely, because it meant that they had been doing research, you know, prostate cancer research using cervical cancer cells. So that meant a lot of research money wasted, a lot of, you know, big controversy. So this one scientist decided to track down her kids and sort of treat it like a crime scene. He figured if he could get DNA samples from them and compare them to all these cells, if they were in fact HeLa, they would match her kids. So he sent this postdoc to call her husband one day, and her husband had a third grade education. He didn't know what a cell was. And the way he understood the call was, we've got your wife. She's alive in a laboratory. We've been doing research on her for the last 25 years, and now we have to test your kids to see if they have cancer.
And the postdoc is from another
country,
China, right? So there's another. So there's like all sorts of communication.
Right, right. Yeah, so she was from China, had not been in the U.S. very long, had a very thick accent, and Henrietta's husband also had a very thick accent. Neither of them could understand anything the other one was saying, and which just added to the problems. And this is when the family got sucked into this world of research. And so I say this because at the time, you know, Deborah, they didn't know this idea of a cell being alive. Her husband actually thought initially they had her in a cell like a prison cell. That was his only reference point for the word cell, and no one stopped to explain it to them. So these scientists would come to the house and take samples, and Deborah would ask questions about the cells. You know, can you look in them and tell me what my mother's favorite color was and whether she liked to dance? You know, can you tell me about her by looking at these cells? And at one point, one of them gave her a medical school genetics textbook and said, here, you know, read this. This will tell you what you need to know about your mother.
Because everybody who hasn't graduated from high school can just jump right on that.
And so no scientist had ever come forward and really tried to explain anything to them until this scene that I'm about to read you, when we went into this laboratory at Hopkins. And the scientist who's there, his name's Christoph, and he had reached out to me after reading a newspaper or magazine article I'd written that just gave a little bit of an overview of the Gila story and the story of the family. And he said what I hear from scientists all the time, which was essentially, oh my God, I had no idea. I've been using these cells in my lab, you know, my entire career. I did my dissertation on these cells, and I never stopped to wonder where they came from. And he felt really bad, and he wanted to reach out to her family. So we went into Hopkins so that he could teach them what cells were. I'll just read a small snippet from that. Christoph walked toward us through the lobby of his building, smiling, hand outstretched. He was in his mid-30s, with perfectly warm denim jeans, a blue plaid shirt, and shaggy light brown hair. He shook my hand and Deborah's, then reached for Zakaria's, but Zakaria didn't move. "Okay," Christoph said, looking at Deborah. "It must be pretty hard for you to come into a lab at Hopkins after what you've been through. I'm really glad to see you here." Christoph threw open the door to his lab with a sweeping ta-da motion and waved us inside. "This is where we keep all the cells," he yelled over a deafening mechanical hum that made Deborah's and Zakaria's hearing aids squeal. Zakaria's hand shut up and tore his from his ear. Deborah adjusted the volume on hers, then walked past Christoph into a room filled wall to wall with white freezers, stacked one on top of the other, rumbling like a sea of washing machines in an industrial laundromat. She shot me a wide-eyed, terrified look. Christoph pulled the handle of a white floor-to-ceiling freezer, and it opened with a hiss, releasing a cloud of steam into the room. Deborah screamed and jumped behind Zakaria, who stood expressionless, hands in his pockets. "Don't worry," Christoph yelled. "It's not dangerous. It's just cold. They're not minus 20 Celsius like your freezers at home. They're minus 80. That's why when I open them, smoke comes out." He motioned for Deborah to come closer. "It's all full of her cells," he said. Deborah loosened her grip on Zakaria and inched forward until the icy breeze hit her face, and she stood staring at thousands of inch-tall plastic vials filled with red liquid. "Oh, God," she gasped. "I can't believe all that's my mother." Christoph reached into the freezer, took out a vial, and pointed to the letters H-E-L-A written on its side. "There are millions and millions of her cells in there," he said. "Maybe billions. You can keep them here forever, 50 years, 100 years, even more. Then you just thaw them out and they grow." He rocked the vial of HeLa cells back and forth in his hand as he started talking about how careful you have to be when you handle them. "We have an extra room just for the cells," he said. "That's important, because you don't want HeLa cells to contaminate other cultures in a lab." He explained how the HeLa contamination problem happened, then said, "Her cells caused millions of dollars in damage." Seems like a bit of poetic justice, doesn't it? "Oh, my mother was just getting back at scientists for keeping all them secrets from the family," Deborah said. "You don't mess with Henrietta. She'll stick HeLa on your ass." Christoph reached into the freezer behind him, grabbed another vial of HeLa cells, and held it out to Deborah, his eyes soft. She stood stunned for a moment, staring into his outstretched hand, then grabbed the vial and began rubbing it fast between her palms, like she was warming herself in winter. "She's cold," Deborah said, cupping her hands and blowing onto the vial. Christoph motioned for us to follow him to the incubator where he warmed the cells, but Deborah didn't move. As Zakaria and Christoph walked away, she raised the vial and touched it to her lips. "You're famous," she whispered. "Just nobody knows it." Stop there. Thank you.
Now, I know that there's probably a lot of questions in the audience, and so I think now is the time, yes?
We have microphones in the audience.
Yes, so if you want to ask a question, please raise your hand. There's some gentle people with microphones who will come to you. And if you guys don't have any questions, I'll just keep asking.
Thank you for coming. What I'm really interested in, if you could tell us a little bit about her family right now, what their monetary situation is, how if their lives have improved?
They're pretty much the same as they were in the book. They're still struggling. I mean, their family's very big, and you know, the foundation's been able to help with some things, school for some of the kids, but you know, there's no way that can sort of make a dent in the whole family's financial situation. So they still don't have health insurance, most of them. They're still really struggling, and you know, they've gotten to a point where they feel pretty positive about the cells. Like, they really aren't angry about the cells themselves anymore, but they're still very much waiting for some money to come to them because of this, which probably won't happen. A lot of these companies that sell the cells and are, you know, they're concerned about setting a precedent. And they say, you know, if we give them money, what about the millions of other people whose cells are used in research? You know, who gives them money and what happens to science and will that inhibit the progress? And so that's sort of been sucked up into this larger debate about who should benefit, you know, who should commercialize science. And so they're in the same situation, but lately they've been starting to get, you know, people are interested in having them come speak places, and they've been, you know, venturing out here and there. They're also working, you know, the book is being turned into a movie for HBO, which is being produced, I guess they mentioned that, right, in the intro, produced by Alan Ball and Oprah. And they're actually consultants. Her sons are consultants in the film, so they're involved in that too. But, yeah, but again, that's sort of, their needs are bigger than that.
And you're talking about generations who lived in poverty.
This is a lot of
people who are living on public assistance for years.
Yeah, and this, you know, the book, as you said, is about a lot of different things. And one of the things that it's about is class and poverty and how difficult it is to get out of that. And the ramifications, you know, education and healthcare and all the things that go along with it. But there are the younger generation, I think, they're going to school. They're working pretty hard to hopefully break the cycle of poverty. The women, the younger women more than the younger men, unfortunately. But
to ask a question about the daughter-in-law, the son's wife who kind of rescued the children when they were younger, recognized the deafness.
Yes.
I see her as a hero in the story. Could you talk more about her?
Yeah, she absolutely was a hero. Babette, she married Henrietta had her oldest son was 16 when she died, and the younger ones were much, much younger. And so her older son married Babette when he was pretty young. And so Babette was really there from the beginning, and she came from a very different, you know, the family, the Lacks family grew up in this little, you know, tobacco farming town in Southern Virginia, came to Baltimore. But you know, they came from a place where, you know, Henrietta and her husband were cousins. It was very common for cousins to marry cousins. And, you know, the things that male cousins did to female cousins was pretty, you know, brutal and just part of life in the country. And Babette, you know, when she saw what was happening to Henrietta's daughter, Deborah, she immediately was like, wait, this isn't actually right. People, you don't have to live like this. And no, your cousin should not be able to do things to you. And yes, you will stay in school. And I mean, she, no question, saved Deborah's life. And Deborah more than the sons. But she also stood up for the sons, too. She was the person who eventually realized that they were being abused and took them away from the abusive mother. So she absolutely, and she's still around. She comes out to my events and sort of sits there in the front row and sort of is scary. If anybody gets up and says anything that she doesn't like, she'll turn around and so she's very much still the matriarch of the family, and yeah, she's unquestionably one of the big heroes of the book.
Picking up on the family story a little bit more, one of the things that was difficult, I thought, at least for me, was it seemed like the family and in the book, Day got a pass on his behavior, both his behavior toward his wife and the neglect of his kids. Ethel was abusing his kids, and he knew it. And it seemed amazing that nobody ever condemned him.
Nobody called him on it. Yeah. Yeah, and also that, you know, Henrietta died from a sexually transmitted disease. And, you know, her cervical cancer was caused by HPV. And he brought home, and when she was being in the middle of her treatment for her cancer, you know, she was in the middle of radiation therapy, and she suddenly showed up with gonorrhea because he brought it home. So, yeah, he definitely had done some running around. You know, and Deborah and Zakaria, for a while, were very angry at him. And they, Zakaria in particular, he really thought that his father murdered his mother. But then he really, they let that go. And in part because they realized that he really didn't understand. You know, he came from such a different place and time. Like, you know, in the 50s in the South, in a small tobacco town, like everybody had syphilis. Everybody, this was what you did there. And it was part of, you know, didn't make it right. But, you know, Deborah really strongly felt like, you know, you kind of couldn't condemn him for what he did in that way because he didn't know any better. And, you know, and he had syphilis, which can cause, you know, some pretty severe brain damage. And I think Deborah at a certain point really believed that, you know, he had lost some of the capacity to understand what was going on. And, you know, as a writer in the book, there are some people who say, you know, you should have, you know, said he murdered her. And, you know, they really want me to take him to task for that. And I feel like my job as a writer is to put the story out there. This is what happened. It's in there. And everybody draws their own conclusions about who's responsible for what. You know, there's questions about what Henrietta did. And, you know, she very well could have gotten that HPV on her own. We have no idea. But so I thought it was important to include in the story because, you know, she died from a sexually transmitted disease. But, you know, I think in part the family really forgave him for that. And so that's where the book sort of stands. And the abuse, in some ways, it's similar. I mean, Deborah and Zakaria were angrier at him about that. They had a harder time giving him a pass on that. But again, I felt like, you know, not my role to sort of say one way or the other, just to put it in there. This is what happened. And that's my attitude that was my approach with all of it. The science, the family story, you know, I don't take a stance on things. I felt like it was really important to tell all the sides of the story, put it out there, and let people decide how they felt about it.
Ms. Sloot.
Yes.
I don't have a question, but I do have a statement.
Okay.
My name is Dr. Fletcher, and I want to congratulate you on having written this book so that it opens up a discussion among physicians in regards to medical ethics that we may not necessarily have had in the past. It helps us to understand why we have HIPAA laws now, and that it's not just a barrier for us on a day-by-day basis. And I just wanted to say how many of my fellow physicians are very grateful to you for having written this book.
Thank you. Thank you. I get emails, I think especially from younger physicians and researchers, but really from across the board saying, those stacks of papers I have to fill out, now I'm not mad about them anymore. And that, that is a wonderful thing for me to hear. And, you know, it's interesting. I think the general public often assumes that scientists and doctors are really unhappy about this story being out there, that I've somehow outed them about something they were trying to hide, which isn't the case at all. I mean, I think across the board, I hear those kinds of responses from physicians and researchers saying, yeah, this has opened up an important conversation for us and between us and the general public. And so thank you.
To me, one of the most amazing things in the whole amazing story was this needle in a haystack piece where you go and find her sister and her records, and it has a picture, and it's just, you're able to track down that really sad story, and it was so nice that you could come to a conclusion and take her with you to the end of that conclusion and bring her some peace, but along the way, which is so heartbreaking.
Yeah. That chapter of the book, people often say, you know, what was the most shocking thing that you found as you were doing your research? And, you know, there was so much that was shocking, but that chapter was so beyond anything that I could have possibly imagined. And this was, so Henrietta's sister was 15. She died in an institution that had been called the Home for Crazy Negroes. And, you know, this was the 50s in the South. She was a young black girl, and she was institutionalized because she had epilepsy, and she was deaf. And at the time, you know, Henrietta got sick and couldn't take care of her. And she died in this institution. And, you know, Deborah always had this feeling that something horrible happened to her sister, and she really wanted to know what it was. And neither of us could have imagined what it actually was. And, you know, she was used in research that was far more barbaric than anything that happened to Henrietta or the other kids, completely unrelated to HeLa cells, also without the family knowing. And, you know, being a black person in the South in the 50s was a very difficult thing. Being a young black girl in an institution like that was just unthinkable. And neither one of us, we couldn't have imagined what we were going to find. And, you know, in some ways that was really, that moment in the story was very dangerous for Deborah. She just emotionally, it was really hard for her to handle. Her blood pressure went through the roof. She was in physical danger during some of those moments because, we found this picture of her sister that was very horrifying to find. And it was just plopped down on the table in front of us. And, you know, there was no time to say, do you want to see this picture? And, you know, how would you like to handle this picture? Or shall I describe it to you first? And there was just poof on the table. And so for me, that chapter in the book was pivotal for a lot of reasons. And that was sort of one of the moments that I realized I had to be in the book as a character because I had put her in this situation where she was exposed to something that turned out to be, in the end, as you said, a good thing for her, but pretty dangerous along the way.
Hi. Somewhat earlier in the book, you mentioned that Deborah had taught you more about race than any other person that you'd met, and I wondered if you could speak to that.
Race, religion, probably everything. You know, I mean, I grew up in Portland, Oregon, which is not known for its diversity. and, you know, we came from such different cultures on so many different levels, religion, race. And I think just the whole experience of my time with the Lax family taught me a lot about race in this country. And I think in part it taught me how far we still have to go, how much of the pain of the past is still lingering, which is, it almost sounds cliche to say because we do say it all the time, but it's really true, particularly when it comes to stuff having to do with medicine and science. And just really seeing the personal effects of living with this legacy of, you know, African Americans being used in research, particularly their family, and just, you know, the way that race permeates everything in their lives. But for Deborah, it was also very much about class. So for her, these two things were, you could not separate them. And she was adamant about the fact that this is not just a story about race. This is a story about class and race. And those two things are often intertwined in a way it's really hard to separate out. But that she was like, this story is not just about black people. This story is about everyone, particularly people who don't have money. And so she felt like it was important to, even though that the race history was all a part of this, to really make that distinction. And for her, you know, she got heat for that. Like there were times when she got heat for talking to a white writer. You know, there were various black people who were somehow connected to the family would come along and say, you know, you should not be talking to a white writer. And she actually felt like it was really important that I was white, which I resisted for a long time. She was like, you know, she would say over and over, I don't think a black writer could get the information you're getting. And I was like, that's ridiculous. You know, we have no, you know, I just refused. And she really insisted and insisted. And I think she's actually right in some cases, because a lot of the scientists that I was dealing with grew up during segregation. They were the scientists who were doing research on black people. And they were open with me. I got to go through their file cabinets. And I think that, you know, she was right in that way. And I didn't want to believe that. But, you know, it was true. I think
with some of these older stories, did you feel like you were chasing down a history that was almost out of reach?
Absolutely. Yeah. And that was one of the, for anyone who's worked on a project, whether it's a dissertation or a book or a research project, anyone who's worked on a project for a decade knows it's like that feeling of hanging over your head at all times is really overwhelming. But for me, I had this additional strain of feeling like this history was vanishing as I was researching it. I've constantly felt like I was scrambling after something that was disappearing.
Like Dr. Guy. Mm-hmm. You talked to him.
No,
right?
He was dead before I started working on
the book.
But other people. but Henry and his generation and George Guy's generation were all in their 80s, pretty much, and some in their 90s. And there were times when I would interview someone and then they would die, like a week later. Or there was one time.
And then
where
the next one totally would not take her call.
That's right.
Scloot? No.
Sorry. We heard what happened to people who talked to you. And then there was two different times where I tried to interview people. I had appointments to interview them, and they died before our appointments. And this was like, you know, I was going to go on a trip to go meet, you know, something. It's not like it was within a week of, you know. But so I had this feeling that it was all vanishing as I was doing it, and so did a lot of the scientists. So one of the things that was amazing to me, just kind of going back to this idea of scientists being open to the story, was how many scientists heard from other scientists that I was working on this book and came to find me to give me information. So, 'cause they knew that their generation was dying and that this was a history that was disappearing with them that no one had really documented. And I got this, and various times people would call me or send letters with information that they thought would be helpful. And there was one time I got a letter from a neurosurgeon, and it said, "I've just been diagnosed with this malignant brain cancer, and I will probably be dead by the time you get this, but I've been going through my files, and I found this thing that I think you would be interested in, because I know you're writing about the history of Gila." And I looked at it, and it was a catalog page from the first company to ever sell HeLa cells, and it listed the price, who was selling it, how much they were selling it for, and I had been looking for documentation of how much HeLa cells had been sold for years, and I couldn't find it. And he was, in fact, dead by the time I got it. But that just says so much about science in general. I mean, there is this sense of really wanting to share and document information. And, you know, I think that I often tell that story to people who say, you know, obviously scientists, you know, were they resistant to sharing information with you? Like, no. If anything, you know, they were...
It was like his dying wish was to send this to me. Yes.
Yeah. So then I often walked around with this feeling of like, oh my God, I have all this information and I have to write this book because if I don't, it's going to vanish with me. And it's like, there was one point where I got sort of stressed about it, and I told this good friend of mine who's a great writer, it's like, if anything happens to me, here is where the tapes are. Here's where, like, I went on this trip and I called him and he was like, "You're crazy. What are you doing?" I was like, "No, just promise me if I die, you will write this book." And I carried around a bit of a burden surrounding that for a while.
I just wanted to ask you to speak a little bit about, you mentioned the spiritual, the religious part, and I thought that was really kind of interesting how you handled it as a writer. I love the part with Gary. I thought that was really one of my favorite parts, because I could feel as a writer that you were holding back any kind of revelations you were having, except the title of the book kind of suggests it's not called The Immortal Cells, it's called The Immortal Life.
Oh, the title of the book, yes.
Yeah, and so, and in that conversation with Gary, you had said most people thought of the immortal cells, but they saw her as an angel, as an immortal life.
Right.
So
right.
If you could speak a little bit, if you want to give us a little bit about any realizations you had about that.
Mm-hmm. This often comes up in events because, you know, I say in the book, you know, I was not raised in a religious family. And if anything, I was very uncomfortable even talking about religion. You know, my experiences before meeting the Lacks family, you know, surrounding religion was like occasionally people knocking on my door trying to convert me. And that was pretty much my religious experience. And yeah, and then, you know, I met the Lacks family and I read the Bible for the first time and I went to churches and I saw faith healings and, you know, was on the receiving end of what looked a lot like an exorcism in that moment. You know, this is where her cousin really saw that she was struggling and was in this really dangerous place and literally just did this sort of laying on of hands and tried to, you know, said, "Lord, you got to take the cells from this woman," and tried to put them into me. And yeah, the holding, I don't know that I would say that I was holding back. I mean, I was certainly holding back in that scene in terms of not wanting to put my own experience of it on there. But people often ask, "So were you saved? Like, were you converted?" And the answer is no. But the whole experience just completely changed my understanding of religion. And I really developed an appreciation for the positive role that faith plays in people's lives and the ways that faith can be incredibly healthy and also the ways in which that it can coexist with science. You know, scientists often talk about, you know, science, always science versus religion, and these two things can't get along. And what I saw with the Lacks family were the ways that religion actually helped to open them up to learning about the science, and that these things weren't incompatible at all. And for me, that's what those chapters really were in some ways about that. And it's funny, when I do these talks, every once in a while the scientists will stand up and say, you know, so were you ever able to straighten the family out on this whole her soul is alive in their thing? You know, and they say, you know, did you ever explain that to them? And my response to them is, well, can you prove that it's not? You know, and I think that's something that is amazing about this, the story in the cells, is that what you believe about the cells and Henrietta really comes down to what you believe about life and death and what does DNA mean and how much of you is in your DNA. I mean, these really big questions that are different for everybody. So I think that's an important part of the story.
This book has been an incredible part of your life for a long time. And I'm wondering, in what ways has it met your expectations, exceeded your expectations, and or failed to meet your expectations?
That's a good question. You know, it's funny. I think that when the book came out, so the book's been out for a bit over a year. It came out in beginning of February 2010. And my life just went, oof. You know, I've been on the road ever since. I've been doing this, you know, constantly, and it's been this back-to-back interview. And I think that I'm still in somewhere in my head, I'm still in this place of going like, whew, I finished it. You know, and like my the whole thing has been such a whirlwind. I haven't even been able, I think, to sit back and really take in everything that's happened. But along the way, I have these moments that are just so astounding to me, where, you know, I was just yesterday at UCSB where they along with like 60 other schools have picked this book as their freshman read. So all entering freshmen have to read this book at UCSB, and it's actually the community read in the city of Santa Barbara. And the school got 8,000 copies of the book and gave it out for free in one day. Just like gave it to every student that they showed up and wanted a copy. And, you know, I have these moments where I see something like that and just go, you know, as a writer, it's you can sort of only dream that, you know, even like this many people will read your book. And I know writers who spent a decade or more working on incredible books that deserved enormous readerships that didn't get them because, you know, they were published the same day that, you know, Bush's memoir came out. Or, you know, I have a friend who had a book that she worked on for over a decade. It was published on September 11th. No one ever read that book. And you can't take it back once it's been published. So the publishing industry is so fickle, and there's so much of what happens with your book once it's published that is out of your hands, that I feel really fortunate that people are reading it and doing so in the enormous numbers that they're doing it. And at the same time, I can sort of look at it and say the reaction that people are having to the book is the same reaction that I have. So I completely get it. That doesn't surprise me. Because there, you know, the first time I heard the story, I was like, what? I have to learn more about this. I have to tell people about this. And so the reaction I see people having to me is about the facts of the story, which are just so amazing. But yeah, I think these moments, I just feel I certainly never imagined it could be, I mean, especially the schools. I think for me, that's really the biggest thing, because so much of the book is about things that need to be discussed by younger generations of not just scientists, but, you know, lawyers, patients, anyone really. And so to see a younger generation reading it and talking to them about it is pretty great. So that, I think, exceeded my expectations.
Thank you to Rebecca Skloots.
Aloud Audio is produced by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles and made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, Righteous Persons Foundation, the National Endowment for the Arts, City National Bank, K&L Gates, KPMG, the Bujaki Foundation, Susan and David Rosenblum, Wallace Foundation, and Donna and Martin J. Wolfe. Media support provided by KPCC 83.9 FM and KUSC 91.5 FM. Additional support provided by the Council of the Library Foundation and individual Library Foundation members. Aloud theme composed by Larry Karish.